actually my first trip abroad from Russia was to Poland, where I won a classical piano competition. But at the time, on the street in Poland, you could buy tapes. I think bootleg tapes would be fair to say. And so then I remember for the first time buying and then hearing recordings of Keith Jarrett and Chick Corea and Bill Evans. And that was certainly revolutionary and mind-blowing for my ear.
Russian pianist Kirill Gerstein has always had one foot in the classical world and the other in the world of jazz. He even had the chance to study with Gary Burton and go off to the Berklee School of Music, where he studied more jazz and continued his career as a classical pianist. He won the Gilmour Prize in 2010. It's been an exciting ride, and it's one of the reasons that his new recording is such a good fit. It's called The Gershwin Moment. Enjoy this week's episode of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Kirill, let's start off by talking about your experience with jazz music from a very early age, which really came from your dad's extensive, or your parents' extensive, record collection. What were some of those most impressionable recordings when you were growing up?
The one that does come to my mind that I can clearly recall hearing as a child was Oscar Peterson and Dizzy Gillespie playing duets, just the two of them. And so I remember being terribly impressed and taken by that. And then there were some other recordings that I don't remember as well what exactly they were, but there was some Dixieland that I thought was absolutely fabulous. And, you know, because this was at the time the so-called Soviet Union, and so some of the jazz recordings came from the Eastern Bloc, so we had some Polish jazz recordings and some recordings from the Czech Republic. And I just remember being very attracted by the sound of this music that really was unlike anything I was studying in the classical realm.
You taught yourself how to play jazz. Were there maybe some jazz pianists that you were emulating?
Well, I think, again, Oscar Peterson at first comes to mind. Eventually, when I was able to acquire some recordings, but this was already, so I thought I was already playing some jazz, and I had gone, actually my first trip abroad from Russia was to Poland, where I won a classical piano competition. But at the time, you could buy on the street in Poland, you could buy tapes. I think bootleg tapes would be fair to say. I don't think they were officially licensed, but there were a lot of jazz recordings. And so then I remember for the first time buying and then hearing recordings of Keith Jarrett and Chick Corea and Bill Evans. And that was certainly revolutionary and mind-blowing for my ear and imagination. And so those were, I think, some of the early examples that I remember being very taken by.
It's interesting because George Gershwin had one foot in the world of jazz. In fact, he did a great job bridging these two worlds of jazz and classical music. He was also, well, he was criticized for that. Do you find that you run into that in any way, shape, or form, being that you really are a classical pianist who's also dabbling in jazz?
Well, it's an excellent question, because I think that has been changing I think it has even changed in the last couple of decades that I'm aware of, and certainly has changed very much, let's say, now in the last 100 years since Gershwin, and I think to a large extent because of Gershwin's impulse. But certainly I think there's been for a long time from certain quarters a criticism of, you know, how seriously should or can one take the music of Gershwin, and how seriously can one take a pianist that plays Gershwin, and also how strict do these divisions between the so-called classical and so-called jazz world? How strictly are these borders enforced? And then it's very telling who has been busier trying to be strict about it and who hasn't. And in the case of Gershwin, we know, and it delights me, that people like Arnold Schönberg, sort of the high priest of the second Viennese school, actually thought of Gershwin in the highest possible fashion about his musical and compositional talent, and so had Ravel and Otto Klemperer. Less so at home, and this is an interesting thing, less so in the American classical music establishment. And I think that has been changing a lot. In fact, the essay that's included with this recent album of mine, and we titled the album The Gershwin Moment exactly because the feeling and the belief is that now is Gershwin's time, in the sense that I think one no longer questions whether he belongs in the, in the pantheon of great composers. And in this essay, Joseph Horowitz, a cultural historian, suggests that for a pianist from my generation, it has become much easier to play Brahms and Beethoven and Rachmaninoff, and then also to play Gershwin and not worry whether this is to the detriment of the so-called serious reputation. But I think that was not the case 30 or 40 years ago.
That's pretty amazing to think about, because his music, lives on, and that in and of itself says a lot.
Yes, well, also it's interesting to just imagine that Porgy and Bess was done at the Metropolitan Opera for the first time in the 80s. And that some of the pieces of Gershwin did not appear on subscription. They were always part of the Pops repertoire, but did not appear on subscription until the 90s or early 2000s in a big American orchestra. So that's an interesting thing to contemplate.
I was thinking about the version that you have of Rhapsody in Blue on this recording, which is from 1924, and it is the jazz band version of this piece that Ferdy Grofe orchestrated for the Paul Whiteman Band. Why did you choose this arrangement?
Well, the oversimplified answer is because I think it is better, but there are some reasons why I think it's better. This is, as you said, the original band version, and that is the orchestration that was premiered at the Aeolian Hall at that famous Paul Whiteman concert in 1924. And I think it's better in a sense. It's jazzier. It's more compact, also due to the number of instruments, but not only, but also to the character. And I think in this version versus the more common symphonic orchestration that we hear, I think the band version also allows other influences on Gershwin's music to come through. And so I think there are certain moments that clearly show the influence of klezmer music that Gershwin heard growing up. That comes through in the band version of the Rhapsody in a way that it doesn't in the more posh and plush version that is the symphonic one. The interesting thing also is that, as you said, Ferdy Grofe orchestrated, in fact, both the band version and then later the symphonic version. But only a year and a half later, the Concerto in F is all Gershwin's doing. So there one sees the staggering progress that he was making as a composer and also as a craftsman, because he did not feel comfortable enough yet to orchestrate the Rhapsody in 1924 and resorted in some way to the brilliant help of Ferdy Grofe. But 1925, he produces the Concerto in F that has incredible orchestration, one that William Walton said that he thought this was one of the most terrific examples of orchestration. I find it always interesting to think of how quickly these geniuses were developing, aside from the grand initial talent.
This recording is culled from four consecutive concerts in St. Louis with David Robertson conducting. Each performance unique, even though it's the same repertoire. Unique, though, because you're adding your own embellishments as well as a cadenza in that concerto in F. Tell me a little bit more about those embellishments and that cadenza in particular.
Well, we know that as Gershwin himself played, for example, the Rhapsody in Blue, that there were stretches that he improvised. So I think it does not go against the spirit of the work that some parts of it may be, as you said, embellished or improvised. And there have been always a couple places in the Rhapsody and a couple places in the Concerto in F where I feel that really is fitting. And obviously, as in any improvisation, any jazz improvisation, it should relate to the material and not be foreign. In these live performances, there were four concerts, and so each night was different. So in fact, David Robertson, I remember him saying, said, well, this is going to be difficult to choose which one of the improvisations you keep, because we sort of had version A, B, C, and D. But that gives it a sort of, I think, that life quality that sometimes is particularly attractive, that it really isn't the same every night.
I also noticed that you chose to keep live comments from the stage in this recording. So if anybody doubted that it was live, they certainly know when you're talking. Or is it you that's talking directly to the audience?
No, it's in fact David Robertson. And I think after the first movement of the concerto. Which ends in a very exuberant way, and the audience so spontaneously applauds, which I think is lovely. And then David turned to the audience and said,
"We're still going to play the other two movements."
We decided to keep it for two reasons. One is, yes, it's a live document, and another one, there's a practical reason to it, because we really did not have any patch session or any additional recording time that sometimes is planned into projects like that. So we just have these four concerts. So in fact, we don't have an ending of the first movement of the concerto, or the third movement of the concerto for that matter, where the audience doesn't start applauding right away. So there was no way to edit it for there not to be applause. And then we decided, well, it's a live recording, so there was applause. So,
and you were okay with the applause after the first movement?
Oh yes, this big discussion whether it's okay to applaud. I mean, first of all, in any case, in a piece like Gershwin, I think many of these concertos, his included, but not only, are designed to elicit an excited response. It's rather unnatural to imagine that after the first movement of the Gershwin concerto that everybody sits in you know, dead silence in a concert hall. So I think in any case, in a piece like the Gershwin, but generally I find that with very few occasions where it doesn't fit, I think audiences' enthusiasm and listeners' enthusiasm is not to be discouraged. So when these periodic opinion pieces arise with, you know, they applauded, they didn't applaud, they shouldn't have applauded, I think essentially if one feels moved to applaud, I think then it's absolutely fine that one applauds when something ends incredibly softly, tragically, and there is a long silence. I think listeners feel that and respect that with some silence for longer. But I think when something ends in an excited fashion, it's also very strange that then this natural impulse has to be stifled.
George Gershwin himself performed the Concerto in F with the St. Louis Symphony in 1936. Did anybody have any memories to share about that? Did anybody, was there anybody talking about what that experience had been like with the orchestra way back when?
Something is shared on the wall of a hotel next door, because there's a plaque that says, when George Gershwin performed the Concerto in F with the St. Louis Symphony, this is the hotel he stayed in. Otherwise, I think there is a sense of a deep tradition in St. Louis, which is something that I find admirable and endearing with that orchestra. I think that sense of tradition and style is very clear in how they approach older pieces than Gershwin's music, but also in the way music of Gershwin is approached, as well as more modern American repertoire. And so perhaps there wasn't a specific story that was told about the Gershwin's visit, but I think there is a deep familiarity and at-home-like feeling with this music in that hall. So in that sense, I felt that doing it with St. Louis Symphony and David was the ideal choice for this repertoire.
I want to ask you about an important mentor to you who also appears on this recording. Tell me how you met Gary Burton.
I was backstage at a festival in St. Petersburg. I think I was about 12, and it was a jazz festival, and it was past midnight. And Gary made his appearance, and probably lucky for me, I could speak English. And there were a lot of people around that couldn't speak English but wanted to speak to Gary. And so I ended up translating for him for an hour or so. And then at some point he said, "What are you doing here at 1 o'clock in the morning?" And I had explained that I had also played at the festival, and he was very kind and interested and said, "Please send me a recording of your playing," which I did. And then even kinder was the fact that he replied and invited me to come to Berklee College of Music in Boston, where he was the vice president at the time, in addition to his very active and important career in jazz as a performer. And so I came in 93 to the summer program for 5 weeks, which was really eye-opening for me, because, you know, I was interested in jazz, as we discussed, but in the city where I was growing up, and generally in the Soviet Union at the time, it was not an art that one could easily experience, both in terms of recordings and scores and live performances. And so here I came to Berklee, and, you know, there was the library with everything one could think of and more, and there were the teachers that played with the students, there were the students that played, and there was Tower Records around the corner. And so so it was just like a fountain of information that I splashed in for 5 weeks, and then they said, "Well, we would like to offer you a full scholarship and have you come as a full-time college student, and Gary was sort of instrumental to all of that taking place and happening. So that's actually what brought me to the U.S. and to Boston. And then for several years, I was concentrating more on the jazz side of things for myself while continuing to study the classical repertoire. And Gary and I have stayed in touch in the years since. And in 2012, I came back to Berkeley and did a concert. And one of the things that we played was this Oscar Levant song that's become a jazz standard called Blame It on My Youth. And the reason to include it on this all Gershwin album is, of course, because Oscar Levant was a very close friend of George Gershwin, and also the pianist that played the Rhapsody in Blue and Concerto in F the most, aside from the composer, perhaps. And so it has that historical connection, but for me, it has the personal and sentimental connection, and also the chance to have a track with somebody whom I've admired since childhood, then was my mentor and is a legendary jazz musician and a dear friend.
And the only piece we haven't talked about is the version of Summertime with Storm Large. And this actually was an encore that the two of you did together at the Gilmore Festival. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, what happened is that initially I met Storm at the Gilmore Festival at the concert she was singing with the Pink Martini group. And then a year or so later, I was in Portland, Oregon, where she lives, and I was playing with the symphony, and I knew she was in the audience, and I told the staff of the Oregon Symphony that I needed a microphone because that concert hall is large, which is true, and that I needed the microphone to be able to announce my encore.
Summertime.
What I didn't tell them is that Storm and I decided to do a surprise encore there. So I used the microphone to introduce Storm, who then used the microphone to sing. And I think the staff of the orchestra were initially shocked, but I think pleased. And that song was Summertime, and that led to us deciding to do a let's say like a cabaret evening at the Gilmore Festival with some jazz standards and some songs that Storm herself composed. So a mixed evening, and Summertime was one of the numbers on that program as well. And so this recording is actually from that concert at the Gilmore.
Up singing, oh baby, then you'll spread your wings and you'll take to the sky.
As you talk about your bridging of these two worlds, jazz and classical, and being a very versatile artist, it makes me wonder if maybe that's one of the reasons you were nominated for the Gilmore Prize, which you won in 2010. Do you think that might be one of the reasons?
Who knows? And the ways in which the Gilmore Committee works are benevolent and mysterious. So I don't know, but perhaps in any case, I know that for me, it's been always important and interesting to explore whether this is truly a boundary, this the world of jazz and the world of classical, and how porous or hard is this boundary. And I think generally I see more and more, and I think that's a positive trend, that these stylistic boundaries matter less and less. I think people are less and less busy with them. I think people are more accepting, and generally I think, and I'd like to think, that the direction that we're headed in is that that we're rather more occupied with the quality of whatever it is than its denomination. So I can think of things that, I don't know, if this is a classical composition, does this have influences of jazz or pop or whatever, but I can tell that its effect is beautiful, its craftsmanship is skilled, and I think that's what's important. And I think I'd like to think that we're heading in that direction, and I always liked to head in that direction. So in that sense, I don't think that I feel that there's such a significant difference between playing Gershwin or Schoenberg or Rachmaninoff or Bach for that matter, because I think the general principles are very similar, and they're designed to aim for the two ears and the souls and minds of many, many human beings.
With Daddy and Mammy, standing by.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julie Almacher.